How would you like to win a $50 gift certificate to Concordia Publishing House? There are two ways you can win. One, write the best invitation to your Facebook friends to become fans at the Issues Etc. Facebook page. Or two, invite the most friends to become fans at our Facebook page. Send an email to contest@issuesetc.org with the text of your invitation and the number of friends you invited. We'll give away the CPH gift certificates October 1st. Invite your Facebook friends to become our fans today. Welcome back to Issues Etc. The headline reads, French Senate votes overwhelmingly to outlaw Islamic face veils. And you say, wow, why? That seems like an awful intrusion into one's personal dress. What's the real problem here? Joining us to talk about this vote today of the French Senate to ban Islamic face veils, Dr. Alvin Schmidt. He's professor emeritus of sociology at Illinois College, author of the book, The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West. Dr. Schmidt, welcome back.
Well, thank you.
What's the real problem that the French Senate is trying to solve there in this Western European country?
Yeah, well, that's a good and an interesting question, particularly in this day and age when a person like, and by the way, this veiling of France does not apply to a scarf or anything like it pertains to the burqa, where you only have a slot over the veil that goes over the face visible for the eyes so that the person can see and walk. That's what it's referring to. It doesn't refer to any other head covering or scarf. That's perhaps not made clear. But it's the real burqa, where the person is really totally hidden and sort of peeks out of that slit that is open for the eyes. And the real problem is really a couple of problems. One, in this day and age of terrorism, anyone, even a terrorist, could hide behind that particular garment and engage in terrorism. That's one. I have not seen the French argument why they don't want it. I have not been able to find it, but that at least is a potential argument. It is also an intrusion, for example, as we had a couple of years ago, and I don't know how that was resolved, with a woman, a Muslim woman in Florida, who, with the burqa, wanted to take the driver's license. And, of course, as you and I know, when we go to take a driver's license, we have to have our a picture of our face taken. Well, if you have a burqa with just the eyes visible, that person is not identifiable over against any other person that wants to disguise herself. So that's a problem. And then there is another problem that we often don't really recognize, and it really goes to the heart of our concern relative to multiculturalism. When individuals introduce drastically different cultural practices, there has always been in the history of societies a strong resistance, because it indicates a rejection. It indicates that you don't want to be part of our culture, that you really are in many ways challenging our culture. So that's another reason, I think, that lies behind. And then it's not an unreasonable reason. And if you go back in history, for example, when early Christianity rose, the Romans didn't like the Christian because it was a different culture that came into play. And so you can say, number one, the person's identity is hidden. It could be someone who wants to engage in terrorism. You wouldn't know the difference. Number two, it handicaps police, for example. If you get stopped for driving and this is the picture you have on your driver's license, well, is it the real person or is it somebody else? You wouldn't know. So it handicaps the enforcement of law as well. And then third, as I said, the cultural concentration that is really conveyed by such symbols. And this is what it is. It's a symbol really saying to Western culture, in your face.
Is there a failure or a resistance to which France is kind of particularly sensitive, of immigrant Muslims to assimilate?
Yes, this has been overwhelmingly shown in wherever Muslims live. They rarely assimilate, and if they do, it's about two generations later than non-Muslims. You see, when a Muslim assimilates, he, and particularly the women, really lose their Islamic identity, their Islamic beliefs, because the veiling of a woman, you know, is in essence spelled out, not the burqa, but the veiling of women is spelled out in three different verses in the Quran. It is also spelled out in the Hadith, which is the traditions and sayings of Muhammad. And Sharia law has a paragraph on it as well. Now, and it actually, I might say, you know, many times one can say that Islamic culture is really 7th century Arab culture. And you might even, relative to the burqa, argue it goes back. There's evidence that the burqa existed in the 300 B.C. in the Assyrian society, where women, aristocratic women, wore the thing to distinguish themselves from the general populace. So it is an old, old cultural practice that was then picked up by Muslims and given a religious connotation.
And that goes for a lot of Islam, doesn't it? I mean, kind of cynically viewed, but realistically viewed, Islam is an attempt to kind of religiously codify an ancient culture?
Oh, definitely, definitely. And as I often say, and I said a little moment ago, that, for example, Islam is essentially the revival or the resuscitation, whatever you want to use, of 7th century Arabian societies.
All right, then. How would you respond, or how would you counsel someone to respond to an argument that's often made that the burqa is not only a part of their religious identity, but it is culturally a way that women are protected in Muslim society?
Well, yeah, of course, that's the argument that is often used, but that begs another question that needs to be asked. This means that, for example, men who are not veiled, or really what it posits is that the men are sexually uncontrollable, therefore a woman has to veil herself or put herself in garments that in no way would excite the male sexual desires. But it really is saying that we have a problem with the Muslim men, and they need to be taught to internalize certain values as we try to do it in Christianity, namely, this is not something you may do. And the onus or the burden of proof lies totally on the woman, not on the man. He is free to, you know, to have his sexual desires, and if the woman entices him, he's free to rape her, basically. So it's, in a sense, it's there to protect the woman, but it really is also saying that there's a great flaw here that pertains to men. They need to be re-educated and taught that to control their sexual impulses. And that, of course, is rarely ever done because that is, again, not part of Islamic or Quran teaching in the Quran. There's no such thing to inhibit men to do that. And so that's basically the history behind it.
There have been accusations not only in France, but here in the United States in different circumstances, of these kind of reactions being evidence of Islamophobia, the new term of art. What are your thoughts there, Dr. Schmidt?
Well, that term, of course, so loosely used to intimidate any kind of resistance to the burqa, and it sheds more heat than it sheds light. Islamophobia, again, what is meant by it? If people, for example, identify themselves as Islam and they want to engage in terrorism, as many, many, many of them have and continue to do, are we then guilty of a phobia, a fear that is unrealistic? Not necessarily. There's a long history, for example, of Muslim violence, not just since 9/11, but long before that. If you go back to the Middle Ages, preceding even the Crusades, there was a lot of violence. It goes all the way back, in fact, to Muhammad, who used the sword, and we have many passages in the Quran that are called the sword passages, where the unbeliever, the infidel, is to be killed. And we have a passage in the Quran where it says, "Christians, do not make friends with Christians and Jews." Now, if that underlies Islamophobia, well, I guess one would say it's not unrealistic, not an expectation that should not be anticipated. It's going to happen because, but just the mere phrase, Islamophobia, is often used in a way like we do in our society. If you don't like a given position, politically speaking, you call a person a racist, then immediately our conversation and debate is stopped because nobody wants to be accused of that. And so it's usually used as a method to intimidate people and to stop them from discussing the real issue.
Dr. Alvin Schmidt is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College. He's author of the book, The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West. When you purchase The Great Divide using the Amazon.com link at our website, a percentage of your purchase will help support the worldwide outreach of Issues, etc. Just go to the Listen On Demand page at issuesetc.org and look for The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West by our guest, Dr. Alvin Schmidt. Dr. Schmidt, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
When we come back the last half hour of the program on this Tuesday afternoon, we'll spend observing, along with the rest of the church, Holy Cross Day. I'll admit I hadn't known about the observance of this day on the church calendar until I had been a pastor several years. And that's for someone who grew up, was baptized, went to church every Sunday, was confirmed, and spent the better part of my young adult life in a church called Holy Cross. What is Holy Cross Day? Does it mean that we venerate or worship the cross? What about crucifixes? And why are fewer and fewer churches both displaying the cross and, even sadder, preaching the cross as the center of their message? We'll observe Holy Cross Day with Pastor Scott Kinneman of Concordia Publishing House on the other side of the break. It's Tuesday afternoon, September the 14th. Your phone calls invited, 1-877-623-MY-IE. Talk back at issuesetc.org or send us a tweet at issuesetc. Stay tuned.
Wouldn't it be great if more of your fellow parishioners listened to Issues Etc.? Well, here's an easy way for you to publicize Issues Etc. at your church. Go to the support page of our website, issuesetc.org, and you'll find a short paragraph to include in your weekly church bulletin. Copy and paste the text for your church secretary or pastor to include each week in the Sunday bulletin. The bulletin blurb is updated weekly, issuesetc.org. Stay connected, issuesetc.org.
Issues Etc. is listener-supported. That means we rely on you for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. Please consider making a tax-deductible gift to Issues Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org, or by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for your support.
We love our on-demand listeners. You're listening to Issues Etc.
New legislation threatens to silence pregnancy care centers.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
Recently introduced federal legislation would direct the Federal Trade Commission to regulate more strictly the advertising of pregnancy care centers. Proponents of the measure say that such centers deceive women into thinking they can get an abortion there when they cannot. But CareNet President Melinda Delahoyd has a different take on the bill. What's happening is that pregnancy centers have become an integral part of a community support network for women and children. With such holistic support available, women are empowered to choose abortion alternatives, and the abortion industry simply doesn't like losing business.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.